Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Good morning. I'm Jesse Edeguin, mayor of the city of Berkeley, and I'm honored to join you for this session of the Bay Area Book Festival. And free speech is part of Berkeley's DNA, and several blocks from here, the free speech movement was born. And our commitment as a city to free speech has never wavered. But over the past year, Berkeley has been a battleground in the fight over free speech. Some have said that we had to choose between public safety and free speech, but that really was a false choice. And this panel covers a timely issue, and one that I've certainly thought a lot about over the past year as mayor of this city. I was elected the same night as our president, and certainly bittersweet. And since that time, the city of Berkeley has had at least five large events. Some of these protests were over conservative speakers at the UC Berkeley campus, others organized by right-wing provocateurs with various affiliations emboldened by our president's hateful rhetoric. And throughout all of it, the city of Berkeley has really been caught in the middle. And while it's best to denounce hateful rhetoric espoused by protesters, we absolutely need to be a platform for allowing a diversity of viewpoints, because it is it's a bedrock of our democracy and a bedrock of our community. So this panel really, I think, will cover some important issues around the issue of free speech, our commitment to free speech. And with that, I'd like to introduce our distinguished panel. Nadine Strossen is the former president of the American Civil Liberties Union and the author of a really incredible book, which I encourage you all to purchase, which has been a very useful book to read. Why should we resist
hate?
Why should we resist it with free speech, not censorship?
If I could interject, you know, the book design literally makes it a little bit hard to read the word hate. And I kind of like, so the picture's worth a thousand words. Free speech is overcoming, and equal protection are overcoming.
Absolutely.
In this constitutional font, overcoming the hatred.
And Nadine will be interviewed by Erwin Cherminsky, Dean of the UC Berkeley School of Law and a noted constitutional scholar. So please join me in welcoming them, and thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
It's truly an honor and a pleasure to be with you. This gives me an opportunity to get to speak with and interview one of my heroes and also a very dear friend for over 30 years, Nadine Strossen. Let me, before we begin, ask everyone to be sure and turn off their cell phones and pagers. And also, I want to be sure and acknowledge the sponsor for this event, the UC Berkeley Arts and Design. And with that, we can get started. We're going to have a conversation for about an hour, and then we'll open it up for your questions. The thesis of Nadine's book is that hate speech is protected by the First Amendment. So this seems to me to lead to the logical question, why?
Okay, and Professor, if I may answer a question with a question, what is hate speech? And if I have to start the answer there, as I'm sure Erwin will appreciate, because there is no category of speech labeled hate speech defined by its content or viewpoint or message that is automatically excluded from First Amendment protection. It's not like obscenity, which is a subset of sexually oriented expression that has been defined by the Supreme Court and excluded automatically if its content meets certain criteria, unprotected by the First Amendment. However, hate speech, and I'll stop the air quotes, you get the point, it's not a constitutional law term of art. The way we usually use it is to refer to speech that conveys hateful or discriminatory messages based on people's identity, race, religion, sexual orientation, and so forth. And speech with that message may be punished and should be punished if, in particular contexts, it directly causes certain specific, imminent, serious harm. And so the way it's described in everyday speech and by politicians and even lawyers who should know better, we often hear two opposite generalizations, each of which are equally untrue. One, hate speech is not free speech. That was said by Howard Dean when Berkeley decided not to let Ann Coulter speak here. He said there's no First Amendment problem. That was wrong. There's no automatic exclusion. On the other hand, there's been too often an assertion that, or an implication, that hate speech is always protected. And that's equally untrue. So the more I delved into the actual nuanced line that our law draws between the speech that is with a hateful message that is protected and the speech with a hateful message that is not, the more I came to appreciate that the law really is fair and makes common sense.
Before we get to talking about the law, I want to talk about scholars who have said quite powerfully that hate speech inflicts injuries. I think here are scholars like Charles Lawrence and Mari Matsuda, John Powell on our campus, who's a former executive legal director of the ACLU, and they talk so eloquently about the ways in which hate speech inflicts emotional injury. They speak of how on campuses, hate speech causes traditionally excluded groups to feel unwelcome. How do you respond to them and the evidence that they point to?
See, I dragged out Irwin's fabulous book, too. And look, they're color coordinated. But the reason that it's a wonderful book, and I only read it after I had written the first draft of mine, but Irwin and I come out similarly on so many crucial issues, including this one. We are not, I'll speak for myself now, you can read Irwin's book and see how he said, makes the point. But hateful speech does, in fact, or certainly can, cause serious harm. Not only psychological and emotional trauma, but often with physiological manifestations. It may indeed lead to potential violence or discrimination. And in my book, I sincerely acknowledge and thank every single one of the scholars that Irwin mentioned, as well as a number of others, because they really were pioneers in calling our attention to the serious injury that hate speech could potentially inflict. Now, I have to say, potentially, because there are steps that we can take to prevent hate speech from having a harmful impact. Number one is counter speech, denouncing and refuting the hateful message and supporting those who are disparaged by it. And here I want to pause because I don't know how recently you've read those landmark articles, law review articles that you mentioned, Irwin. I was very surprised when I went back and read them for writing this book. I had read them many times, but probably most recently, maybe about a decade ago. They came out starting in the early 1980s. And I was struck that every single one of those authors stressed that at that time, people who were subject to hateful speech felt no support in their surrounding communities, and that the harm they experienced, including on campus, was at least as much resulting from the feeling of being isolated and abandoned as it was from the initial hateful speaker himself or herself, because they felt that, well, they must be speaking on behalf of the whole community or the community doesn't care. And they complained that the media didn't even cover these incidents. Well, obviously, there's been a sea change since then. BuzzFeed did what they called the first comprehensive survey of hate speech on campus since the 2016 election. I don't know why they picked that benchmark. It wasn't because of the election of your wonderful mayor here, I'm sure of that. And that survey was reported toward the end of 2017. The somewhat surprising news was every incident of hate speech is too many, but it was 157 incidents on 120 campuses. That's not horrendous, given that we have 5,000 campuses. As I say, it's every one is too many. But what was especially heartening was that the students responded, including the minority students, that the university had handled the situation appropriately with deans and presidents and student body presidents and the campus community and generally rallying around the disparaged people and against the hateful speaker. And this is what's so encouraging to me, particularly members of minority groups on campus, including those who are targeted with hate speech, feeling more and more self-confident and empowered about speaking up for themselves. That's not their responsibility. It's the responsibility of every single one of us. But it's wonderful that they feel the ability to do it and to do so very effectively.
Before we talk about those alternatives, I want to go back to all of these articles that talk about the harms of hate speech. And you're recognizing these harms. We create categories of unprotected speech when we believe that it's harmful. You mentioned obscenity because it was perceived by the Supreme Court as so harmful. There are other categories you talk about in the book. Why not create a category of unprotected speech for hate speech? You began by saying it's not, and I agree, but should we in light of the harms of hate speech?
You know, my conclusion, and this might be a little bit too nerdy for us law professors to get into in detail, but my conclusion after examining the current state of First Amendment law is that obscenity is really the only categorical exception to free speech that the Supreme Court still recognizes, and it's very controversial. The court just hasn't revisited it in many years, but as Irwin knows, it's been... But
Child pornography is a category. False and deceptive advertising is a category.
But it's the only category that's based on societal disapproval of the message as opposed to a more tangible harm. Child pornography consists of the depiction of an actual child who is being used and therefore inherently abused and exploited in the production process. I think the next example you gave was commercial fraud, so somebody is misled to his or her detriment. Every other example of speech that's unprotected, there is some specific imminent serious harm. And the mere fact that we even loathe the message, even the vast majority of us loathes it, has not been enough to justify exclusion with this sole remaining, I think, anachronism of obscenity.
Let me just push back a little bit.
Sure.
As you say, those categories are unprotected speech because they're perceived as causing harm.
Mm-hmm.
Child pornography, harm to children, false and deceptive advertising, harm to consumers. What Charles Lawrence or Mario Matsuda or John Powell would say is hate speech causes harm, so we should have it be a category of unprotected speech as well. How do you respond to that?
Well, because the specific harm, and I'm not denying that it exists, is... Well, threefold, really. Psychological and emotional trauma, which is certainly significant. It may well have physiological manifestations, and which then has ripple effects, right? Adversely affects your educational experience or your work experience. And I would also add, it's really important to recognize that free speech is on both sides of this equation, right? If you're subject to, and I speak from experience, I've been subject to hate speech, and I remember the very first time, I describe this in my book, that I was subject to vicious anti-Semitic speech. I was already a graduate of another law school, not quite as good as the one you are deaning now, but a pretty good one.
And we went to the same law school, but we put that aside.
I had an excellent job with a very prominent Wall Street firm, and I felt self-confident, and yet I was absolutely shattered. I can still vividly recall when it happened, and people who know me, including my dear husband, will tell you how extraordinary it was that I was stunned into silence. So I say that smilingly, and I know there are many other people who have been subject to infinitely more hate speech than I have, but I personally understand that it can lead to these harms, but those kinds of harms occur from an infinite array of speech that conveys disturbing, upsetting, offensive messages. I dare say you hear things that certain politicians say and you find it very upsetting. And I don't say that lightly. I know people who were deeply traumatized as a result of certain statements that were made, not because they directly affected them, but because it depressed them about the state of the country. So if we allowed speech to be suppressed for those reasons, we would really have no free speech left, and we certainly would not have free speech left for any speech that strongly criticizes the status quo, dissents from government policy, criticizes government officials, advocates justice. As I researched my book, I became painfully aware of how often, for example, advocacy of Black Lives Matter and other social justice causes has been assailed as hate speech that is causing trauma among white people in general or among police officers or relatives of police officers. And Black Lives Matter activists even have been accused of hate crimes, of instigating murders of police officers. So basically, to use an old cliche, yes, there is at least potential harm, in many cases actual harm, but the cure is worse than the disease. It's worse to hand power over to government officials to make the necessarily subjective decisions about, well, which emotional harm should be protected by punishing the speech that causes a negative emotional reaction in a particular audience member.
Let me push back a little bit on that. Every European country has a law that prohibits hate speech. They're able to be democracies and still prohibit hate speech. They seemingly avoid the slippery slope that you describe. If they can prohibit hate speech, should we in this country?
Another interesting fact that I learned from doing the research for this book was I had predicted it. It makes common sense that laws that are enforced by government officials who are accountable to the majority are predictably not going to be enforced in a way that is friendly to members of minority groups, whether they be political minorities, ethnic, racial, other minorities. I knew from American history and the studies I had done, you know, I had written and spoken on this issue frequently, and then I got a little bit burned out, and for 20 years I took a break. And to that point, I had seen the predictable pattern that, no, these laws are enforced the way our drug laws are enforced, to take an example that's been very widely publicized, disproportionately to the disadvantage of the members of racial minorities, right? Especially young, dark-skinned men. And what was not surprising, very sad, supports my case, I wish it weren't the fact, but not surprisingly, in all these countries, as well as Canada, Australia, South Africa, South America, you name it, we see that pattern over and over and over again. And not only political critics, but also racial minorities have had the laws used against them. Those who are challenging the status quo and human rights activists who are advocating on behalf of equal rights have been convicted of hate speech. I think my favorite example is France, which has, France and Germany probably have the strictest laws in the world. And in France, the head of a Parisian gay rights group was criminally convicted and saddled with a serious fine, I think it was about $5,000 in U.S. terms, for using the term homophobe against the leader of an anti-LGBT rights organization. France has such strong hate speech laws that even includes criticism of an Israeli government policy has been deemed to be criminally punishable hate speech. So Le Monde, as most of you know, is sort of like the New York Times of France, was actually criminally convicted for criticizing a policy, a particular policy of the Israeli government. So yes, they haven't slid down a slippery slope toward China or that kind of complete repression, but it's not a society I would want to live in terms of being free to criticize those, I think, who have abused human rights. On the other hand, so it's like the worst of both worlds. What do we know about, stick with the subject of anti-Semitism in France, or for that matter, in Germany? Just a few days ago, the head of the Jewish community in Germany told Jews that they should not wear the yarmulke, the kippah, in public, even if that was their deep-seated religious belief. We're talking Germany, right? A country that has the strictest hate speech laws because of their Holocaust history. And I'm sure you all saw the most recent specific incident that got a lot of attention from last week, when an Israeli Arab who was visiting a German Jewish friend said, this is ridiculous. He was disputing this edict that had been issued by the head of the Jewish community. It doesn't make sense. Jews could not be in any trouble here. So he put on a kippah, and sure enough, he was brutally beaten, and I'm sure you saw it on YouTube. That was, and we're not talking about, I've got to watch what I say here because I'm from Minnesota, but let's say we're not talking about, some rural, extremely conservative area that voted for the right-wing party in Germany. We're talking about Berlin in one of the hippest, trendiest neighborhoods. So, and that's an anecdote. There are statistics that show all of the human rights agencies from the UN and regional bodies are deploring the frightening escalation in not only anti-Semitism, but not only discriminatory words and speech, but violent actions against a whole host of minorities, including immigrants and Muslims and LGBT individuals and the Roma, the Gypsies, and so there's no correlation between the enforcement of hate speech laws and the decrease in discriminatory violence or attitudes or ideas.
In your book, makes the very powerful point that the reverse is also true. Stopping hate speech doesn't necessarily stop hate from spreading. I found one of the very powerful passages in the book is you describe the laws against expression of anti-Semitism in Germany in the 1920s and the 1930s, that instead of it stopping the rise of Nazism, it made into martyrs and heroes those who were arrested for engaging in anti-Semitic speech.
I just have to tell this audience that this is personally very significant to me too, because I am the daughter of a Holocaust survivor who was born in Berlin in 1922. Under the Nuremberg laws, he was classified as a Jew of the second degree because his father was Aryan and his mother was Jewish. But as a teenager, he was also very involved in anti-Hitler political activities. And for that combination of reasons, he was sent to the Buchenwald forced labor camp. And it's just staggering to me to think that here I am, the daughter of somebody who was enslaved, almost died in the camp of pleurisy, and my life was literally saved by the American military, who liberated the Buchenwald camp one day before he was scheduled to be sterilized. So I'm going to quote somebody else who himself was a survivor of the Holocaust, Arye Naier, who was the executive director of the ACLU at the time of the Skokie case. Many of you know what that is. Erwin spent some time in that area, right? 1977 to 78, the ACLU came to the defense of a group of neo-Nazis who wanted to demonstrate in Skokie, Illinois, a town that had not only a large Jewish population, but many of them were Holocaust survivors. And that was deeply unpopular position for us to take in the court of public opinion. We even lost 15% of our members, diehard free speech supporters, who drew the line there. It was a slam dunk winner in the courts of law, including the U.S. Supreme Court, for the reason that Irwin and I talked about earlier, this notion that we call viewpoint neutrality, that government may never punish speech just because the viewpoint is odious. Anyway, Aryeh Nair came under a lot of attacks. How could he, as a Holocaust survivor himself, defend this position? And he really had very much of a consequentialist argument. I was quite surprised when I reread his book that he said, "I love free speech, but I loathe the Nazis even more than I love free speech." So if I believed that censoring the Nazis would have prevented the rise of Hitler, would have stopped the Holocaust, I would have been all in favor of censorship. And I kind of agree with that analysis. And most people are surprised to learn that not only did the Weimar Republic, during which Hitler rose to power, not only did it have hate speech laws that are very similar to the ones that are still in effect in Germany and many other countries, but those laws were zealously and conscientiously enforced. The leading Jewish organization in Germany at the time said that most of the prosecutions were handled fairly. And the Nazis loved it. It became a platform for them. And they were able not only to gain attention that they otherwise would not have drawn, but sympathy. And the same thing happens in this country. When I was writing my book, Irwin, in early 2017, most people I spoke to had not heard of Milo Yiannopoulos. And it was not until efforts were made to silence him that suddenly he became a household word.
Let me ask you some of the hard questions.
I thought the ones you asked were already hard.
I get paid extra for harder questions now. In the book, you point out that free speech isn't absolute. Incitement of illegal activity isn't protected. So-called true threats aren't protected. And harassing speech isn't protected. Where is the line to be drawn on a campus between free speech and harassing speech?
Okay, so one of the really interesting aspects of Irwin's book, and thank you, I hadn't seen this laid out so clearly before, is that we have to be careful when we talk about campus, because there are two different free speech regimes on campus, and I think there's a lot of confusion in public discourse about this. So in the classroom or closely related to research and teaching activities, and I love Irwin's word for it, and I'd give credit to his co-author, Howard Gilman, as well, they use the term professional speech, that we as educators and administrators have a professional responsibility to impose restrictions that will advance the research and pedagogical goals of the academic institution. So to use an example, and I have a former law student here who can attest to this, Rachel, who's now working for Dean Chemerinsky. In my classroom, students, well, first of all, they have no First Amendment rights at all. And I have to, people will be shocked to hear this. Most people don't realize that in a private institution, including a private academic institution, there are no literal First Amendment rights. The Constitution only binds government officials, including public campuses. But there are academic freedom norms that my law school certainly respects, as do most private educational institutions. But the academic freedom norms include engaging in and instructing our students to engage in discourse that is consistent with the particular educational enterprise. So in a law school classroom, I say to my students, you may only use language that would be suitable in a court of law or another professional setting. And you may want to ask follow-up questions about that. But what, one of the wonderful reasons I'm so excited to be here in Berkeley, the center of the free speech movement, as this Irwin's book also explains, as a result of the free speech movement, a new understanding and dimension to free speech on campus was defended and championed and now is widely accepted, universally accepted, and that is outside of the classroom and narrow professional context, the campus is a forum for robust freedom of speech, where as long as the First Amendment would protect it, campus officials should also protect it. So I would say what would be deemed harassment punishable in a classroom or professional setting is more broadly defined than what would be punishable harassment in the non-educational or non-professional context.
You've mentioned now a couple of times Milo Yiannopoulos. I think of Richard Spencer, the white supremacist, and how much attention with regard to free speech is about his hateful expression. I think one of the hardest questions is, how much does a campus have to spend to facilitate hateful speakers being able to come? Where is the point at which a campus can say, we just can't afford this anymore, we can't pay for the security costs, so in order to safeguard all of our students, staff, and faculty, we have to stop the speaker? The free speech movement, Berkeley in the 1960s, was students wanting to speak on campus. What about when it's hateful speakers like Richard Spencer and Milo Yiannopoulos? This campus spent $3.9 million on security in the fall. That's not sustainable. Where can the campus say, we just can't afford it anymore?
And I feel like saying, but it would be such a cliche, what do you think? But the truth, because that's what we law professors do, but the truth is I have been asking every free speech expert and every campus official that I know this question, because it is a very difficult one. I agree with you, Irwin. I have seen one of your published answers to the question. So here's the from the First Amendment perspective, I think the Supreme Court has been very clear, although we may disagree about that. In a case called Forsyth County, quite a number of years ago, it was a case in which the ACLU represented the free speech rights of the hateful speaker. And it was a case where the local municipality pegged the security costs to the anticipated expenses of security, which in turn flowed from how controversial the speaker was, and therefore the size of the anticipated counter-protest. Now, strictly as a matter of First Amendment free speech doctrine and logic, we cannot allow what the Supreme Court has called a heckler's veto, when those who disagree with the message heckle in various ways, impose various impediments, including threatening violence, carrying out violence, leading to increased security costs. If the end result is that the speaker doesn't get to speak, and those who come to hear the speaker don't get to hear the message. So, of course, the logic of that reasoning is security costs should not be taken into consideration. Before I go any further, I want to stress that the concept of the heckler's veto arose, as did so many of our speech protective principles, in the crucible of the civil rights movement of the 1960s, because so many Southern officials and towns said, we can't allow these civil rights demonstrators to speak because it's going to lead to at least threatened violence and probably actual violence, and we don't want that, and we don't have the resources to pay for adequate security, to police protection to prevent the violence. And there were actually bottles thrown and rocks thrown, and it's true that civil rights demonstrations throughout the South would not have been allowed to proceed if that would have been accepted as a justification. So I'm trying to think of ways that we can reduce the security expenses. And one is actually advocated by the Southern Poverty Law Center, which specializes in monitoring hate groups and hate crimes. And their reason for suggesting it doesn't have to do with cost, but I think that would be of an incidental benefit. Playing into a point that you raised earlier, Erwin, they say we have to, so they wrote this guidebook for campuses, what to do when an alt-right speaker or, you know, Richard Spencer or so forth comes to campus. Sadly, they did it last summer because it was so clear that the alt-right white supremacists are increasing their campus presence and their campus recruitment. So they wanted to arm students and equip students in advance to respond constructively and effectively. And their number one recommendation was do not succumb to the temptation to engage in vigorous counter in your face protests. It may be morally satisfying, but it's simply playing into the strategy of the alt-right to increase the attention that they'll get. So, you know, it might be, and I don't want to overstate the point because I understand that in particular situations, maybe vigorous counter in-your-face protests would be the most effective, but I think you should take it into consideration that it wouldn't necessarily be, and it's a strategic judgment in every situation.
I want to follow up on that, given the title and thesis of your book. Yeah. The title says the solution is more speech. So if you have a Richard Spencer or a Milo Yiannopoulos, why isn't the appropriate response a vigorous counter-demonstration, put aside the in-your-face? When Richard Spencer spoke at Texas A&M University, there was a large counter-demonstration in the football stadium. Mm-hmm. Thousands of people came, and apparently it's quite unifying for campus. Wouldn't that be the exact thing you're espousing, given the title and thesis of your book? Yeah.
Well, 2 points, but the more important one is, you know, face-to-face is very significant because in that, I thought, excellent guidance by the Southern Poverty Law Center, they did suggest if you want to have a protest, or they actually said it's better not to stage it as a protest, treat it as your own affirmative event that is affirmatively championing diversity and dignity and inclusivity. In other words, don't necessarily put yourself in reaction. Be proactive and have it far away, both because you don't want to give them the media coverage and the attention. And as I'm saying, another benefit is reducing the likelihood of violence. But I use the term counter speech loosely to mean using our speech, which our freedom of speech, which includes the freedom to choose not to speak or to speak in a certain place with a certain message rather than another place with a different message, to be very deliberate about how we make those choices. And in the book, I say, ironically, one of the most effective forms of counter speech might be, in certain circumstances, silence. But that's making a concerted decision. You know, one of the interesting things about the online world, we all know that, of course, it makes it so much easier to spread hateful speech, but it also makes it easier to disseminate counter speech. And most fascinating to me are the studies that are being done on what is effective counter speech. This is much more easily done online than in the real world. And a lot of the conclusions, they're preliminary because this is a new field, but they dovetail with common sense in an encouraging way. So humor is a particularly effective counter speech device. And very often when I speak somewhere, I'll get somebody from the audience come up and give me an example of humorous counter speech. So this happened a couple of days ago. I was speaking in New York and I got an email afterwards from somebody in the audience who used to work for an old TV show that Michael Moore did. And every month, I think, they had an event where they would counter hate with love. And they would go to, for example, one was some in Idaho encampment where some neo-Nazi group was having a retreat. And they had very, you know, racially diverse, gender identity diverse group of people dancing and romping and throwing hearts-shaped balloons into the air. And they really, and they were filming it all, and they made these hate mongers look so ridiculous. And those who have studied, because I really, you know, I do not give up on anybody. To me, the goal is not only to protect against the potential harm that might be inflicted on individuals or society from hateful speech, but I want to rescue those people from being hate mongers. And I was so encouraged from what I read in my book, in researching the book, how often that has been done. We have organizations, including one called Life After Hate, that consists of nothing but even former heads of hate monger organizations, even for a big period in their lives, being successfully weaned away and now dedicating themselves to preventing others from going in that direction.
I want to combine what you said about so-called heckler's veto and also more speech. What about when groups use their free speech to silence the speech of others? There's an incident at William & Mary where an attorney or ACLU person came after Charlottesville and Black Lives Matter acted in a way, chanting, humming, the person couldn't be heard. Or an incident at the University of Oregon where the president, Michael Schill, was going to speak and students chanted and sang and hummed so he couldn't be heard. Do they have the free speech right to do that?
You have a free speech right to engage in non-disruptive protest, which I would be willing and pretty enthusiastic about defining fairly broadly as anything that does not in a sustained way prevent the speaker from delivering the message to a willing audience. So certainly you have the right to engage in silent protest in many ways, whether it be, you know, wearing t-shirts or armbands or holding placards or turning your back to the speaker or walking out of the speaker. I would even defend, and people may disagree about this, I would defend the right to erupt in shouts for short bursts of time, but not so long that it becomes physically impossible for the speaker to proceed. And that's what happened at William & Mary. Again, you can see it on YouTube. I mean, they were shouting sustainedly. And what was very heartbreaking to me was to see she is the executive director of the ACLU of Virginia. She an alum of that college. She had been invited by students on that campus to tell them what their free speech rights, including the right of protest, are. And she, I thought, had great good humor and aplomb at the beginning when students came in and started shouting. She said, "See, you're exercising your right to protest." But then it went on too long, and they clearly were determined to stop the event from proceeding. And they're the ones who posted the video on YouTube boasting that they had succeeded in stopping the event from going forward. What was really heartbreaking to me as an educator and an advocate was to see that there were students in the audience who really were hungering for the information she was trying to give them. And so they tried to approach her at the podium so they could at least have like more intimate conversation with her, and the protesters even blocked that communication. And that clearly violates university rules. And I think, Erwin, that another strategy that would reduce the security costs would be to enforce the rules and even the laws that are being violated by these disruptors. Now, you know, I defend their freedom of choice to engage in conscientious objection. That's what many civil rights demonstrators did. But conscientious objection means that you're willing to pay the price if you're challenging what you think is an unjust law.
Does the internet change anything? If the hate speech is over the internet, do the rules change at all? Because the internet has become a place for the expression of hate. And should we have different rules for the internet?
You know, when the internet first burst on the media, public, political radar screen in the early 1990s, the ACLU, of which I was then national president, formed a cyber liberties task force, and we asked ourselves exactly that question. Should civil liberties principles, including freedom of speech and privacy, as the preeminent ones, should they change in this new online world? And after studying it a lot, we came to the conclusion that no, the same tried and true free speech principles should be enforced. And fortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court agreed with us 9-0 in a case called Reno versus ACLU. That said, I do have to point out that most of the online, so we stopped the government from engaging in censorship online. But the powerful private sector entities that now dominate the online world, Facebook, Google, and so forth, are exercising what is in effect censorial power. I say in effect because, as I mentioned earlier, they are not governed by the First Amendment. To the contrary, they have their own free speech right to decide what speech to include and what messages to exclude. So that's a very important topic, which in some ways is beyond the scope of my book, focusing on the government. But I do use the opportunity of the book to spend a couple sections looking at how those companies have enforced their own anti-hate speech laws, and they reinforce exactly the same problems that we've seen when government actors enforce these laws. They are enforced in a way that is disproportionately disadvantageous to anyone who is challenging the status quo. So going back to just using Facebook as an example, since 2014, a large coalition, almost 80 civil rights and civil liberties organizations, including the ACLU, have recurrently protested and complained to Facebook that it's discriminatorily enforcing its anti-hate speech standards, such that it's treating people who complain about police abuse, including Black Lives Matter protesters, pipeline protesters, other social justice warriors, their speech has been taken down as hate speech. And there's an object lesson learned there. I think there's a lot of pressure. I understand many people feel also the concern that they're not doing enough to protect against actual punishable speech, such as threats and intentional incitement.
I'm increasingly uncertain whether the traditional law can be applied to the internet. We need separate rules. Take campuses. There's usually a difference between on-campus speech and off-campus speech. The internet and social media make that distinction irrelevant. When you think about harassment, the ability to harass people, and it's generally women and people of color over the internet, is very different than any other kind of harassment we've seen. The ability to disclose very private information about people to a mass audience is different. Do we need separate rules for those, at least for campuses?
We might. So you're talking about online, right?
Right.
Yeah, we might have to. And seriously, this is going to be the subject of my next book, and maybe yours too.
Oh, good! I get to do a commercial for your next book.
But I always have to. I always think of that aphorism of Winston Churchill. You know, democracy is the worst form of government, except for every other one that's ever existed. So I truly appreciate the risks and the dangers of speech, including the additional risks and dangers of online speech. But I always say, compared to what? Compared to letting, as a colleague at the Electronic Frontier Foundation put it, the bros of Silicon Valley, do we trust them to make these decisions? Do we trust Big Brother, Donald Trump, or state and local counterparts?
Sure.
So sort of like, whom do we distrust more? But I think they're at the very, very least, we have to come up with specific non-sensorial techniques that would deal with some of these problems. And I do have to say, you know, you don't have to wait for my book. There are wonderful efforts have been made. Reports have been issued by PEN USA, which is a writers and free speech organization, did a terrific report last year about the problem of fake news online. And, you know, after deep study, acknowledging that it's a very serious problem, they not only concluded that a more speech approach is a better one, but they had very detailed, specific, concrete recommendations of how do we operationalize that and make counter speech more effective.
I want to go back to your thesis, and especially the concluding part of the book, where you talk about more speech as the best solution. Why believe that more speech can really cure the effects of hate speech? When people experience hate speech on campus, especially traditionally underrepresented groups, mm-hmm. can more speech really provide any cure?
Well, there are actually, and my book includes some examples, and I'd be happy to provide more of where it actually has made a difference. I told you that in terms of the psychic harm, even those who initially brought those to our attention at the very same time said counter speech would do a great deal to alleviate the harms. Even more proactively, I quote some mental health experts, psychologists, and so forth in the book, who say that we can be trained in advance to become resilient to and therefore immune to the potential pangs of hate speech. And I was really encouraged to read specific examples of, there was one program I described from Stanford Law School where, and it focused on Jewish students and LGBT students who really did encounter hateful expression with overwhelming attitudes of looking down on the speaker. It didn't diminish their own sense of self-confidence. They had pity or contempt for the speaker. And I'm encouraged that specialists believe that we can train all of ourselves, all of us can learn to deal with that kind of stress in a positive way. The other strain of speakers that I quote in my book to this point are Barack Obama and a whole host of minority leaders, political activists who say, you have to learn how to deal with and avoid and surmount the potential adverse impacts of hate speech. That's what the civil rights movement leaders did, and you owe it to yourselves and to your community. Now, I would never say that myself. Who am I to talk to somebody who's been in a traditionally discriminated against group? But when somebody from that same part of society is urging them, both for their own effectiveness and happiness as individuals and activists and for the benefit of their communities. And I quote a whole lot of others in the educational realm, somebody who, along with Irwin, is one of my heroes, Ruth Simmons, who was the first African-American president of any Ivy League university and the first female president of Brown University. Way back in 2001, she said, you know what I hate? I hate it when people say, I don't want to listen to that because it makes me feel uncomfortable. And she said, I believe that education at its best is the antithesis of comfort.
Okay, I'm a university administrator. Imagine there's a hateful incident in my school. What do I do? And this isn't hypothetical. In the fall when Alan Dershowitz spoke, someone within Berkeley Law School drew a swastika over his picture. Now, I don't know if it was somebody within our school or an outsider. It doesn't really matter. Okay. What do I do in response to that hate speech in light of your commitment to more speech?
And, there we can discuss the nuances here, but I think there are two guiding principles. Number one, I believe that people in a leadership position, such as Irwin at his law school, have a moral responsibility to speak out, to explain that certain hateful expression is deeply inconsistent with the most fundamental values of that educational institution. If it were an example where the speech was itself protected, and I'm not clear from the facts that you gave me, if it was vandalism, you know, defacing university property, that would be a crime. But assuming that it was protected speech...
Minor vandalism. There was a poster. It's not authorized to draw on somebody else's poster. Somebody came to the law school and drew a swastika over his face.
I think that one should also say the university defends your right to say it, but we will exercise our free speech right to condemn it. And I would say, as an educator, I would try to find the person and try to, in a non-punitive way, try to educate that person.
Right. And I don't know we'd ever be able to find who that person is, but I wonder if there's not a tension between what you just said and something in the book. Mm-hmm. As I was reading the book, I was looking for something I would disagree with, and I had to get all the way to the end, to page 175, to find it. And you wrote, in a university setting, when intellectual freedom is especially important, there are similar concerns that campus officials, such as university presidents, not convert their bully pulpit into a pulpit for bullying speakers whose views they oppose. You praise something at the University of Chicago, which is called the Calvin Report, that says that university administrators should not use their speech to criticize the speech of others. If you're saying now that I should speak out against the hateful speech, isn't that inconsistent with what you wrote here?
So I didn't intend to praise it, Erwin. I was laying it out as a possibility, and I ultimately disagree with that aspect of the Calvin principle. So as I said, there are nuances here. The University of Chicago Calvin principles seem to bar university leaders from speaking out. And a mutual friend and colleagues of Erwin's and mine, Jeff Stone, who's a very respected First Amendment expert and advocate, really believes that. So when Lee Bollinger, who's the president of Columbia University, another good friend of Jeff's, they've co-authored a lot together, you may remember an incident at Columbia about 10 years or so ago when Ahmadinejad was speaking at the university. Bollinger let him speak, but in the guise of introducing him, vehemently denounced his ideas. And then Jeff published something criticizing Bollinger for having done that. Now, I disagree with Jeff. I think Bollinger was correct to do it, but I use in my book a model that to me is really good in not bullying, right, but explaining and persuading. So it was Derek Bach, when he was president at Harvard, he had a couple occasions to do this. When a student engaged in hateful speech, Bach sent out a communique to the entire campus community. Interestingly enough, Harvard still maintains them on its website many decades later. And he takes pains to say, I understand. Well, first of all, he takes pains to say, you have a right to engage in that expression. I'm not denying your right to do it. I also recognize that given my powerful position, any criticism I issue of your viewpoint may have an unduly suppressive, chilling effect. But that's what counter speech is. I do to some, I want to persuade you not to have certain ideas and not to express certain ideas. And I assure you again that I'm not going to punish you. So I thought that was a very good way of recognizing countervailing free speech concerns.
I promised we'd leave 15 minutes for audience questions. Before we do, is there anything that I didn't ask you that I should have? Anything you wanted to be sure to say that my questions didn't give you the opportunity to express?
No, they were fabulous questions. Okay. Thank you so much.
I didn't need that, but it's... Okay. Now let's take your question. I understand there is a wireless mic, and the only thing I ask is to be relatively brief, to let as many people who want to ask questions have the opportunity to do so, and there's supposed to be a question mark at the end of what you say. And we're at the disadvantage because of the lights. It's very hard for us to see you, so we'll need the people with the microphone. And if you don't have questions, I've got lots more.
You want to comment on why so many in the millennial generation are more accepting of government censorship, suppression of hate speech than our generation?
You know, I have some theses. Erwin had and Howard Gilman had some ideas in their book. And it ranges, I think, so Proposition number one is they do not know enough about free speech principles and free speech history. And I can't tell you how many law students I get who say that they've never studied what we used to call civics. They really don't know basic facts about our government or the Constitution. And I really do believe that even learning what First Amendment law does protect and does not protect, and the reasons why, and historically how the censorship power has been used, I think just presenting that information will go a long way toward dispelling the lack of support. And I think that was what motivated Irwin to write his book as well.
I'd add a couple of things to that. This is the first generation to grow from a young age being taught that bullying is wrong. They've internalized the message. They want to make sure that campuses are hospitable for all students.
And that's so positive. If I can just interject, that is so positive. And I don't think there's been enough attention to the positive values that underlie what might have a negative impact.
This is a generation that hasn't had to deal with censorship. It's a generation that hasn't had to deal that much with the kinds of free speech issues that would produce censorship. One of the things that occurred to me in teaching an undergraduate class on free speech on campus is that the civil rights protests of the 1960s, or the anti-Vietnam War protests that we both participated in, was long ago for this generation of college students as World War I was for you and me. It's a frightening thought, but it's true. Also, I think it's important to recognize that there's no unanimity among college students. There are more college students now, I think, than there used to be, who would want to see a restriction of offensive and hate speech, but I don't think that's the majority of college students either.
I've read two surveys recently that unfortunately say two-thirds of them across the ideological spectrum think that hate speech should be not protected.
And there's studies all over the place on that. Whoever's got the wireless mic is going to need to pick who gets this next question.
Should I speak? Okay, I have a question
where
back
are you,
here.
Please?
Right
okay,
here.
Okay, thank you.
So the rumors around Berkeley about Yiannopoulos' speech were that he was planning to out, by revealing personal information of students who were undocumented, thereby causing potentially harm. So where does that fit? And should he do that? What would be the remedy? Or where does that fit in your understanding of speech?
That is such a great question. When I read that, I actually did some research, and I didn't find, I only had a few minutes, and I in that time didn't find anybody addressing it. My own instinct is that that could be punished, but that's an instinct. What do you think about that, Irwin?
If a student does that to another student, reveals private information, I think that student can be punished. In fact, the law allows for liability for the public disclosure of private facts. There's requirements that have to be met. It's much more difficult with regard to when it's Yiannopoulos. The traditional remedy of the law would be to say that the person who's been outed can sue Yiannopoulos for money damages. So if Yiannopoulos reveals that somebody is transgender or somebody's undocumented, that individual could sue for money damages. That answer, the law seems inadequate. The person for whom private information is revealed doesn't want to make it more public by suing.
Yeah.
And it's not realistic to say, go sue. Now, one thing that there might be the instinct on the part of the campus to do is to stop Yiannopoulos from coming and speaking if we know that he's done this, say, at the University of Wisconsin. But that's in the law of prior restraint. And stopping somebody from speaking, even if they've done something bad before, would generally be thought to run afoul of the First Amendment if it's done by the government.
And so prior restraints are not absolutely prohibited. There's that extraordinarily tough standard that the court laid down in Pentagon Papers case.
In California, the law is that if it's proven that speech is defamatory, a court can enjoin that speech from happening in the future. It's actually a case that I argued and lost in the California Supreme Court. But that would create a mechanism that, again, seems unwieldy. imagine that Milo Yiannopoulos comes to Berkeley and reveals who are transgender, undocumented. Now he's going to UCLA. UCLA could get a court order to keep him from doing that again. And I think that would be consistent with prior restraint doctrine. And if he did it, he'd be in contempt of court. But that's a pretty elaborate and likely unrealistic mechanism. So I don't have a good answer. I don't think the First Amendment provides us a good solution to this.
But so again, it's a great question, and you've motivated me to pursue my research and thinking about it. But you see, we both acknowledge that that would be specific harm. We're just questioning sufficient to warrant punishment, but we're just questioning whether there is an effective punishment or prevention mechanism available in the law.
Hi, can you talk about where the line between between free speech and terrorism lies?
So probably the most relevant doctrine that is one of these doctrines the court has recognized where speech directly causes imminent, serious, specific harm is what's called intentional incitement of imminent violence. It's a tough standard, and it really ought to be a tough standard. The speaker has to intend to incite violence that is going to, or lawlessness that is going to happen so imminently that there is no time for any other mechanism short of stifling the speech to prevent the harm. So law enforcement won't suffice, education won't suffice. And the reason why it's important to have that very strict requirement of a tight and direct causal connection between the speech and the harm is that, as Oliver Wendell Holmes said, every idea is an incitement, if we use that term incitement loosely. It might be believed by somebody who might be persuaded to take action that might cause harm. And before the court enforced that very strict, narrow concept of punishable incitement, the government predictably was using a looser concept to punish anybody who was advocating any change at all, including civil rights demonstrators, anybody who challenged, who claimed that a particular law was unjust. This is exactly why Margaret Sanger and Emma Goldman served time in prison, because they were inciting women to break the law that made using contraception a crime. I would say even now, terrorism for some is the equivalent of what communism used to be for others, the greatest evil and the greatest danger that's feared. And I think one of the terrible decisions that the Supreme Court issued recently was not strictly enforcing that standard in the context of terrorism. So the court allowed criminal punishment for human rights groups that were providing educational or humanitarian assistance to any organization that had been branded by the State Department as a terrorist organization. And, you know, so we have to see the dangers of a looser, broader concept.
And I think it's very important to separate the two parts of your answer. Mm-hmm. I think the first is what the law should be in this doctrine. But the latter part is a Supreme Court case from 2010 called Humanitarian Law Project versus Holder. And it involved a Kurdish group that was trying to form a new nation, but the State Department had called it a terrorist group, and a group in Sri Lanka that was trying to form a new nation, and they were trying to appeal for, as Nadine says, humanitarian aid. And the Supreme Court ruled 6-3 that the Americans who were engaged in speech activities to help those groups were giving material support to terrorist organizations and could be punished. So I think that the law is less protective today with regard to speech that's regarded as material support for terrorism than perhaps it should be, or that your initial part of the answer suggests.
Yeah, I'm certainly no supporter of terrorism or violence. You know, the ACLU and New York Law School were just feet away from the former World Trade Center. So I do want to note that many intelligence officials and counterterrorism experts support this narrow definition because they say advocacy of terrorism that falls short of that actually helps them to identify who potential terrorist threats are.
Be a different standard regarding hate speech where there's identification versus anonymity. And I think of two analogs. I think of the issue of people being able to cover themselves, which was a big issue in our protests this last year, cover their faces. And then I think of another analog even with our campaign laws where now you have to identify the top three or five donors in a mailing with who they are. So it just seems there's danger when people aren't identifying who they are and they aren't responsible for owning their speech.
These questions are so good. I would love to have you in my, you know, all of you in a law school seminar. That's a compliment. You may think it's a punishment, but...
Yeah, if you'll come teach at Berkeley sometime, all of these people can come hear you.
My commercial message.
It's a very hard question, and I think you recognize, and I don't see where the questioner went now, but I think you recognize that we have countervailing concerns that are very important, and the Supreme Court has handled this the way the ACLU has, if I may say, because like the Supreme Court, we try to do our best to maximally protect all fundamental freedoms for all people. And in this one, you have free speech concerns on both sides of the line, right? So as a coincidence, this is the 60th anniversary of a landmark Supreme Court decision that showed the complicated interrelationships between freedom of speech and privacy/anonymity, a case called NAACP versus Alabama. And again, one of countless examples where landmark free speech principles came in the context of the civil rights movement and were absolutely essential for the civil rights movement to proceed. Alabama and other southern states were harassing the NAACP and trying to prevent it from carrying forward with its desegregation activities using every law they could, including censorship laws. In this case, they required the disclosure of members and supporters of the NAACP, which would sadly did result, before the Supreme Court struck down that law, in the 2 years that it was in effect, the NAACP's membership more than halved. So in other words, its ability to carry on its work really was being undermined. And the Supreme Court said that, especially if the speech is controversial and likely to result in economic reprisals, social ostracism, even physical violence or worse, then you cannot have a meaningful, real opportunity to engage in free speech unless you can do so under the cloak of anonymity, right? So, but on the other hand, and the same thing with giving money to controversial campaigns, the same argument is made, or to controversial political parties. On the other hand, there is a real First Amendment rooted value in transparency and information and equality and other constitutional concerns that would weigh in favor of disclosure in these various situations. So in the campaign finance context, what the Supreme Court did and what the ACLU supported was to look at, you know, when you've got these countervailing concerns, the best you can do is you don't draw an absolute, what we lawyers call, bright line rule. Rather, you say, in every specific case, we're going to look at all the facts and circumstances and how can we maximally protect both free speech and privacy. And the court said, look, if it's a minor party, there was a case that involved the Socialist Workers Party. The court said, we're going to protect their donors from having their contributions disclosed for two reasons. Number one, it's such an unpopular party, people people could really be subject to terrible reprisals, such that they would be deterred from making those contributions if they knew that their anonymity, that the contribution would be revealed. Secondly, it's such a minor party that it's not going to have the potential for any corrupting influence. Maybe in Berkeley that wouldn't be true, but nationwide that was the court's
quick
judgment.
Quick follow-up question following directly from that. I was asked this question last summer. There's a right to speak anonymously. Can Berkeley prohibit people from wearing masks at certain demonstrations? Can the UC Berkeley campus prohibit demonstrators from wearing masks?
Well, I can tell you the official ACLU position on that is no, but I think it was probably fact, and I think it was fact specific. The last such case I'm aware of was a KKK demonstration in Manhattan, and I think there, since they would be so outnumbered by counter-protesters, it might not be translatable to here.
Alas, we are out of time. Nadine and I are going to both be in the lobby to sign copies of books, but please join me in thanking Nadine for being here and her wonderful presentation.
Thank you for the great questions.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.